Hey, Time Bandits. Time been, how long? The Perth Fringe Festival is run and done. I had fun. I'm glad you could come. I did not expect to have that much rhyme in the opening, but here we are. We are coming out of the blocks strong. Anyway, Comedy Demo's commitments are now over. I don't have to be a real-life person anymore. I can go back to being an anonymous weirdo on the internet, and all is right with the universe. Ah, it's good to be back. A heads up before we begin the show, you know, don't bury the lead, this is going to be a two-part show. The reason it's going to be a two-part show is, well, you'll see why. It splits neatly into two shows, and it means that I can break up the effort of recording and editing this show, because it is hot as balls here, and I don't have air conditioning, so I've got to try and crank out as much comedy as I can before I pass out from the heat. So that's why summertime, shorter shows, more often. Is that a sufficiently rambling preamble? A pre-ramble? Henceforth, I'll be saying pre-ramble. I like the sound of that. Well, if it wasn't a pre-ramble before, it is now. Let's kick this show off. Onwards. Forward unto dawn, comrades.
It's History Go Time.
If you haven't listened to the Hitler show, then I highly recommend you do that. It doesn't particularly relate to this show outside of this pre-ramble, but it will boost my metrics, and I'm all about their metrics. I'm actually not. I quite often sabotage my own career because I refuse to sell out, but that's what makes this show so fun, right? Anyway, if you'll recall, the premise for the Hitler show is that I weighed up the pros and cons of whether, if one had access to a time machine, whether one should travel back in time and kill Adolf Hitler. And then I gave some very well-reasoned arguments as to why you probably shouldn't do that. And if you haven't heard the show, then I won't go into it any further because, again, metrics, but know that there is some very crucial context around why I am arguing that you don't kill Adolf Hitler. I guarantee that that clip is going to be cut and taken out of context on TikTok or something.
Just slow it down. I'll shoot Hitler out the window. Darn, I hit Eleanor Roosevelt by mistake.
But that show posed a question that kind of got lost by the wayside, and it's a question that I think deserves a bit more attention. If you did have access to this fictional time machine, which single person could you delete from history to have the most net positive impact on humanity? Which single person, if you smothered them with a pillow in the cradle, would do the most overall good for humanity? I've actually given you the answer to this question before in one of the Mongol shows, but I'll be damned if I'm going to sit through that marathon again just to find a clip demonstrating that I was right and knew about this dude before everyone else and their dog did a show about him. So if you want to sit through the Mongol saga again, by all means, metrics, but they're easily my most popular shows, so maybe give one of the others a shot. My personal favorite is the Zarathustra film, and that's the one that everyone else seems to hate. Anyway, I'm monologuing again. It's time for a cross-temporal death note. If you could travel back in time and kill one of history's mass murderers before they could go a mass murderin', who would provide the biggest net gain to humanity? Firstly, the honourable mention. An argument could be made that removing Rupert Murdoch could potentially provide the most benefit to mankind. Certainly, Al Roops has created an environment where the people in power and the political systems that support those people in power, actually pretty much the state of the entire Western world, is directly the fault of Keith Rupert Murdoch Jr. Yes, that is actually his name. His name is legitimately Keith. He chose to be called Rupert, which I think says a lot about his character. If you look out the window right now, witness how fucked the world is right now. Whatever the issue you find with the world, you can more than likely draw a direct line back to Keith Rupert Murdoch Jr. Given how cool we are with the suspension of civil liberties, the rise of neo-fascism, the general dumbing down of the population, and just how blasé we are towards the destruction of the planet we all live on, All of that is because of Rupert Murdoch's stranglehold on the Fourth Estate for the better part of a century. There's a strong, strong argument to be made that mankind will never invent time travel because Rupert Murdoch has not been murdered by a time traveler.
I hit Eleanor Roosevelt by mistake.
But Rupert Murdoch didn't just wake up one day as a billionaire tyrant.
I'm Rupert Murdoch, the billionaire tyrant.
He was born a millionaire, and a total shit, but he wasn't yet a billionaire tyrant. He was groomed for that. He inherited it. Remember, Rupes is Keith Murdoch Jr. Keith Murdoch Sr., who I'll bet is almost completely unknown to those of you outside of Australia, Keith Murdoch Sr. was a creatively evil man who first built the empire that Rupert is now using to destroy the world. He's a Nepo baby.
I suppose you don't like tabloid newspapers either.
There will be more on those two at a later date, but not today. My point is that this wasn't a solo effort. We're looking for the single person who has had the most deleterious impact on humanity as a whole. So who would it be? Who's your guess? Who is number one on your theoretical time-traveling hit list? Have a think about it. Pause the show if you need to. I'll make it simpler. I'll give you a criteria. Which single person is responsible for the most death, disease, injury, maiming, and just general human misery in the history of mankind? Who is it? Is it Hitler? No, of course not. Go and listen to the Hitler show. What about Stalin? Stalin murdered 23 million people. That's a lot of murders. But then Mao Zedong more than tripled that score. There's Leopold II of Belgium. We don't really talk about him for some reason, but if you want some nightmares, do a quick search of the things that Leopold II of Belgium did in the Congo, and welcome to not sleeping anymore. But what about deaths based on percentages of populations? Well, Pol Pot is up there, as well as a firm candidate for the most evil person in history alongside the likes of Leopold II. Julius Caesar wiped out a fair portion of Western Europe. Alexander the Great did the same thing, but on a larger scale. And all of them are absolutely shaded by Genghis Khan, whose kills can be measured in whole percentage points of human population. The list of historical mass murderers is longer than you might expect, and it just keeps getting bigger. Humanity is not the best. Donald Trump, of all people, is on that list. I did not imagine that I would ever be saying that, but here we are. And who said he never achieved anything as president?
You people know a lot about trucks. Bing, 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 bong, bong, bing, 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 bong.
As of recording, over 1 million people in the United States of America have died of the COVID-19 virus, and that number is still going up. Over 1 million people. A 1 followed by 6 zeros. Donald J. Trump is directly responsible for the vast majority of those cases and fatalities. It is directly his fault.
I think that's a problem that's going to go away.
It's going to disappear. One day it's like a miracle. It will disappear.
You have to be calm. It'll go away.
It will go away. Just stay calm.
It's going to go away. It's going to go away.
It will go away. You know it. You know it is going away.
It's going to go away. Hopefully at the end of the month. And if not, it hopefully will be soon after that.
I didn't say it, Dave. I said it's going away. And it is going away.
You were saying things like, I think it's a problem that's going to go away within a couple of days.
It will go away.
It's not that he did absolutely nothing to prevent COVID. It's more that he allowed it to happen because at the outset of the pandemic, it was, according to Trump himself, killing the right people. It est the people in metropolitan centers who were unlikely to vote for him or have voted for him. Democrats.
The Lancet Commission on Public Policy and Health in the Trump Era has just come out with an assessment of Donald Trump's impact on the health of Americans while he was U.S. president. And, spoiler alert, it wasn't positive.
He didn't just do nothing. He actively let the virus run rampant. He actually prevented measures to stop it because it was killing people he would rather were not alive because they didn't vote for him. The United States had a robust plan in place for something exactly like coronavirus, but the president vetoed it because he wanted to kill people who weren't going to vote for him in the upcoming election. That is not an opinion. That is actually what happened. And somehow, in less than 3 years, we seem to have forgotten that. Those deaths are on Trump's hands, and for reasons that still boggle my mind, he has not been hung, he is not in jail, he let 1 million people die for his own personal profit, and he is still out there being Donald Trump, he's still grifting. 1 million people! It's like Joseph Stalin said, one death is a tragedy, 1 million is a statistic. And Donald Trump gets to run for president again! The land of the free, the home of the brave. The house of the I don't know why the fuck their political system is what it is, but holy shit, you guys need to reform it double quick.
I'm an extremely stable genius, okay.
But all of these historical killers are absolute fucking choir boys compared to the person we're going to be talking about today. Because while Genghis Khan may have killed millions of people, this dude killed billions. With a B.
You're a fucking choir boy compared to me! A choir boy!
And while he might not be the grand, sweeping evil of a Hitler or a Stalin or a Leopold or a Columbus, this guy certainly was evil in his own small, petty way, what Hannah Arendt would have called the banality of evil. He was cognizant of what he was doing, and he did it anyway. But it wasn't on the grand scale of the people we think of when we think of history's biggest killers, which is why he gets away with it so much. Well, no longer, I say. Let's shine a light into this dark corner of humanity's rug. You've probably never heard of this guy, which is a shame considering, you know, the billions of deaths. I've been putting off doing this show for a while because his name pops up from time to time on various other shows, and I didn't want to look like I was bandwagoning. Which is why I dropped that little hint earlier that I've done this on a previous show and I've been on top of this topic for a while now, just to sort of cover my bases. But now I think it's time that we finally shone the HGT spotlight on history's biggest killer. Have you ever heard of Thomas Midgley Jr.? Thomas Midgley Jr. was an American engineer and chemist who, somewhat unintentionally, almost destroyed the entire planet. Twice. And not even Genghis Khan can claim that.
What is best in life? To crush your enemies, see them driven before you, and to hear the lamentation of their women.
According to the historian John McNeil, Thomas Midgley Jr., quote, had more impact on the atmosphere than any other single organism in Earth's history. End quote. Not person, organism. This guy has legitimately killed more people than cancer. He is, categorically, the most destructive individual who has ever lived. Thomas Midgley Jr. Now for today's show, we're going to be heading back to the 1920s, 1930s, that kind of period. It's a big period, so let's just say, I don't know, the interbellum. And we're going to be looking at the US automotive company, General Motors. Specifically, their head of research, one Charles Kettering. Charles Kettering was the guy who, among other things, invented Duco on cars, and he looks exactly like Mr. Freeze from Batman.
Nice to see you.
He is exactly what you'd think of if you asked an AI to generate an image of a roughshod capitalist scientist who only cared about profits. And Charles Kettering had an assistant by the name of Thomas Midgley Jr. And Thomas Midgley Jr. looked like Charles Kettering if you put him in a higher gravity environment. He looks exactly like Charles Kettering, but if you squished him. And they are both exactly what you imagine if you were given the prompt, scientist who fucked the world. And that's exactly what they're about to do, these two. They are going to fuck the world. Twice. So they represent the Research and Development Department of General Motors. But at this point, the American corporate scene was pretty incestuous. It was pretty common for companies to lend their R&D departments to each other, If they saw a way to make a shitload of money in the short term in an industry that wasn't quite their wheelhouse, they'd gladly lend out their R&D department to make shitloads of cash in the short, because that's how capitalism works. Never look at the bigger picture. And Kettering and Midgley, at this point, they had a reputation as scientists who could get some shit done. So one day, DuPont Chemicals went to this dynamic duo of Charles Kettering and Thomas Midgley Jr. with a problem. The problem that DuPont had was with refrigeration.
Let's take some ice.
We take refrigeration for granted today, but it's been a pretty big problem for humanity going all the way back to Neanderthal times, right up until about 70 years ago. How do you keep things cool? Hell, it's a problem even today, he says in his unair-conditioned, not studio, but desk in front of a computer, sweating his ass off trying to get this show out in time. Well, the secret to being cool is to be self-confident without being arrogant. That's how Fonzie did it, and that's how you should do it. But the secret to keeping things cool is a smidge more complicated than that. The home refrigerator didn't become a thing until the late 1920s, and it wasn't actually attainable for the average household until the mid to late 1930s, and that was due to the work of Kettering and Midgley. And the reason that cooling things is so bloody hard is because of refrigerants. A refrigerant is a liquid or a gas where you get to decide whether it's a liquid or a gas. I don't want to get bogged down in chemistry here, but it's all to do with states of matter, specifically gases and liquids. That and thermodynamics. I think I've covered thermodynamics at some point in another show, but if I haven't, then just pretend that I have. You know how water boils at different temperatures depending on the air pressure, such as high in the mountains? Well, that's the same for everything else, too. Fun fact, if you ever get sucked out of the airlock of a spacecraft, that's what's going to happen to you. You're going to boil. Sweet dreams. If you can change the state of something but maintain the pressure, you can make it cold. In order for a liquid to evaporate into a gas, it needs to power that process somehow. Thermodynamics. You can't create or destroy energy, just move it from one place to another. So when a liquid turns into a gas, it does so by absorbing heat. And when it condenses back into a liquid, it gives off that heat. So if you can control where a gas turns into a liquid and vice versa, you can effectively move heat from one place to another. That's why the back of your fridge is warm. They need to put that heat somewhere. Thermodynamics. So that's how a fridge works, in the most lay of layman's terms. Aside time, the word refrigerant does not have a D in it, but the word fridge does. Why is that? Well, the honest truth of it, because it would look weird if it didn't. That's the entire reason. Refrigerator comes from the Latin word refrigerare, which means to make cold. That's a long word, so humans being humans, we're going to want to truncate it. But refridge sounds weird. But fridge sounds just about right, so we went with fridge. But if you were to write fridge the way that you would write refrigerator, it would look like frig, F-R-I-G-E, when it's supposed to sound like bridge or ridge, so we just put a D in there to make it look like it's supposed to. I genuinely pity anyone with English as a second language, because it is a total motherfucker of a language to learn. So you've got a big insulated box that you want to make cold. So you need a substance that can be controlled at various pressures and temperatures. A refrigerant. The problem is that the gases that you can use to do this are either highly toxic, highly flammable, or highly toxic and highly flammable. And you're trying to convince everyone to put a canister of this stuff in their kitchen next to the fire that they use to cook their food on the daily.
Inflammable means flammable? What a country!
Which is why refrigeration was only used in industrial settings at the time and operated by trained personnel, and even then they still exploded from time to time. So the captains of industry approached Kettering and Midgley and said, "We think there's an absolute shitload of money to be made in getting fridges into every home. Can you come up with something that doesn't explode?" That is specifically the issue we're trying to resolve right now, the exploding. We're not overly concerned with the long-term ramifications. And Kettering turned to his protege Thomas Midgley Jr. and asked him to get onto it. And get onto it he did. Thomas Midgley Jr. carried a periodic table in his pocket at all times, and he scrutinized this thing for just such an element. I'm not making that part up. The dude actually slept with a periodic table in his pocket, like a massive nerd. Now begins the process of trying a whole bunch of different chemicals to see if they killed animals or spontaneously exploded animals. Science! After some trial and error, Thomas Midgley Jr. came up with the chemical known as dichlorodifluoromethane. It was highly stable, it was non-flammable, and to quote Charles Kettering, quote, altogether without effect on man or animals, end quote. Which was broadly true in like a cosmic sense, but also a massive fib if you care about things like details. Thomas Midgley Jr. tested dichlorodifluoromethane by taking all of the nitrogen out of the air and replacing it with his horrible chlorine, fluorine, methane fart bomb, and then getting some animals to start huffing on it. And the animals were fine. So he put some of this stuff in a test tube and threw a match in it. It didn't go boom. Looks like we've got a winner here. They probably could have done some tests to see if this new chemical was going to do stuff like react horribly with the Earth's atmosphere, but that would have turned the tap on the money hose that they just invented, so what people didn't know wouldn't hurt them. It would, but that's the thinking. It's an important point to make, and it might get lost in this angry diatribe, but there's nothing to suggest that Charles Kettering and Thomas Midgley Jr. knew that their invention was going to destroy the planet. That was just inconceivable at the time. But they weren't going to go out of their way to look for problems either. Just the basics, like bursting into flame. So we've got a brand new chemical that we can use for refrigeration, among many other things. And it's based on the chemical dichlorodifluoromethane. But that, and other chemicals like it, fall under the broader banner known as chlorofluorocarbons, or CFCs, which is a lot easier to say. When presenting his new invention to the American Chemical Society, Thomas Midgley Jr. went the full P.T. Barnum. And I'll say one thing about Midgley here, one performer to another. This guy was an absolute showman. Game recognized game, yo. This guy had it. To demonstrate just how harmless his new chemical was, Midgley took out a beaker of dichlorodifluoromethane, sucked it down until his lungs were full, and then, slowly, in front of a massive crowd of assembled journalists and scientists, he slowly exhaled the entire thing over a lit candle, to the oohs and ahs and slight disappointment of the crowd who were just a little bit hoping he'd explode. But explode he did not, and the not-very-scientifically-literate press said, well, that's all the proof we need that this product is in no way harmful. The future is now. Hurrah for science, woo.
Hurrah for science, woo? Well, I can't say I approve of the woo, but the hurrah was quite heartening.
This product is an absolute winner. Now we can put a fridge in every home in the world without worrying that Mrs. Stepford is going to atomize herself while cooking a brisket. It's time to print money. General Motors, in conjunction with DuPont Chemical, start churning out CFCs on the daily. And naturally, they're not doing this out of the goodness of their hearts. Oh gosh, no, that would be stupid. This is the dawn of late-stage capitalism. Why would you help eliminate food parasites and world hunger for free? Don't be silly. Kettering and Midgley, in conjunction with DuPont and General Motors, patented the ever-loving shit out of their new wonder chemical so that they were the ones making the money and not everyone else. And they called it Freon, and Freon ushered in a new golden age of humanity. For a price. People all over the world could now keep their food fresher for longer without having to worry about it spoiling. We just entered a golden age of nutrition and good eating. Food stayed fresher for longer. Food poisoning was about to become a thing of the past. The housewives of the world no longer had to spend a good portion of every day going to the market to buy food. Groceries could now be done once a week instead of every day. And I say housewives because it was the 1930s and history happened. Humanity is going to eat better than it ever has, all because of this new wonder invention, the greatest thing we'd seen since the Haber-Bosch process. All thanks to the wonders of Freon. All rights reserved. And it didn't stop there. Fridges were great. They were a game changer, sure. But what if we could cool things that weren't a fridge? What if we could cool a car or a house? Or maybe, one day in the distant future, a podcasting studio. Don't be stupid. Welcome to the new world of air conditioning, where mankind truly triumphed over nature. Cool air in the summer heat, once the exclusive domain of the pharaohs of old, now within the grasp of the common man.
Air conditioning repairs an elite worldwide family dating back to the very beginnings of civilizations.
And the hits kept on coming. Suddenly it was possible to make aerosols. If you've got a liquid that you want to spray out of a can, that can happen now. On the back of CFCs, we got spray paint, we got deodorant, we got hairspray. Hell, you could even spray cheese out of a can and piss off the Europeans. Insect repellents and sprays. We were finally free from the tyranny of our insect overlords. It was the future today, and General Motors and DuPont made sure to remind you exactly who you had to thank for that future. Now pay up.
Can't you see it's great to be a modern family?
And this continued for decades, the consequence-free living of the world of refrigeration. Fast forward to the 1970s. In 1973, a chemistry professor named Sherwood Rowland, who has one of the coolest names in history, was researching chemistry stuff at UCLA Irvine in California. Professor Rowland gets a new research assistant who is working towards his PhD, and this new guy needs a project to work on for that PhD. And on a whim, Rowland assigns this researcher, one Mario Molina, a task to study the amount of CFCs in the atmosphere. That's what research assistants are for. You put them on projects that you are kind of interested in, but you couldn't be asked doing yourself. That's why you have research assistants. As luck would have it, the previous year, Sherwood Rowland had been at a chemistry conference, and part of that conference had been a demonstration of a new method of measuring trace gases in the Earth's atmosphere. And among other things, this new method had discovered that CFCs are present in the atmosphere at a rate of 220 parts per trillion. It also detected all of the other stuff in the atmosphere. The CFCs were a very small data point in a large presentation. But it was enough to prick up the ears of one Professor Sherwood Rowland, best name in history. Because that might seem like a small amount of CFCs. 220 parts per trillion is the equivalent of a fart in an empty football stadium. It doesn't seem like a lot. But what alarmed Rowland was the fact that any CFCs at all could be detected. Why the fuck should there be detectable CFCs anywhere in the atmosphere? That is absolutely terrifying. At this point, humanity had been using CFCs for less than 50 years. To have enough CFCs in the atmosphere that they represented 220 ppm, some back-of-the-envelope calculations determined that that was pretty much the entire amount of CFCs that have ever been created, still up there in the atmosphere. Every single droplet of CFC that had ever been sprayed into the atmosphere was still there. They didn't go away. This is a bad thing, because chemicals are supposed to break down in the environment. This is less than ideal. So Rowland suggests to his research assistant, Mario Molina, why don't you have a look into these CFC things? And Molina happily accepts. This is the nice, cruisy stuff that PhDs are made of. He had no idea that he had just stumbled onto the end of the motherfucking world. Chlorofluorocarbons are a unique combination of being both incredibly light and incredibly stable. This is good for things like aircraft, but not so much for man-made chemicals. CFCs do not break down easily, and they're lighter than air. This means that when you use them, they float up above the actual air and hover around in the stratosphere, where they will sit until Judgment Day and trumpets sound. Or about 100 years, whichever is more dramatic. So you've got a bunch of CFCs sitting up there high above the clouds. The problem occurs when ultraviolet light hits them at just the right angle. This happens a lot because space is just chock-a-block full of ultraviolet light. Our own sun is bombarding us with an ungodly amount of it every single day. And when UV light hits one of these CFC atoms just so, it will chip off a molecule of chlorine. Now, this chlorine atom doesn't like being on its own, so it will grab onto the nearest thing it can find. In this case, being so high above the air, ozone. Ozone is a gas that exists high up in the Earth's atmosphere, and it acts like a shield, reflecting back the worst of the radiation that space is trying to kill us with all the time. So this chlorine atom from the CFC hits the ozone atom and breaks it apart into oxygen and chlorine monoxide. Neither of these gases, unlike ozone, protect the planet from space lasers. And chlorine monoxide, unlike ozone or CFCs, is not naturally stable. It breaks down very quickly, and when it does, that same chlorine atom that has been raw-dogging around the atmosphere flies loose and finds another ozone atom to latch onto, and it breaks apart that ozone atom, and then it flies off and finds another ozone atom. It's basically the Pete Davidson of gases, leaving a string of broken hearts in its wake. If ozone is like a layer of bubble wrap protecting the Earth from evil space radiation, then the chlorine that floated up there on the back of CFCs is like a pin that explodes into more pins. This creates a hole in the ozone layer, meaning that more ultraviolet light can enter the atmosphere, which is bad news for anything living on planet Earth, which is a lot of people. We've all heard of greenhouse gases and global warming. Well, the current problem gas that we have is CO2, and that is a huge problem. But CFCs, chlorofluorocarbons, are 10,000 times more potent than CO2 at eroding the atmosphere. They're a much bigger problem. CFCs were everywhere in the atmosphere, but they particularly congregated in one spot, a section of sky in the southern hemisphere. And they ate away at the ozone in that spot, creating a hole in the ozone layer, and a bad time was had by all. I know a lot of you guys live in the northern hemisphere, and you're more than likely aware of the hole in the ozone layer, but you won't know it like people here in Australia know it. The hole in the ozone layer is pretty much right above Australia. We don't have that lovely ozone here to protect us from the worst of the ultraviolet bombardment. The sun is our mortal enemy. So where people in the northern hemisphere might grow up thinking that a tan is something of a status symbol and that sunshine is a great cure for depression, if you're a child born in Australia at any point in the last 40 years, you've been raised from the cradle with the knowledge that the sun is an eldritch murder monster who is trying to melt your skin, burn your eyeballs, and mutate your DNA into horrible cancers, so never, ever go outside without sunscreen, long sleeves, and a hat. The first thing that we all learn in kindergarten is to slip, slop, slap. Slip on a shirt, slop on some sunscreen, and slap on a hat.
Slip, slop, slap, you can slop in Kansas City. Slip, slop, slap.
And if you don't, then you're not allowed to go outside to play, because the sun is trying to kill you. Australia has, by far, the most incidences of skin cancer of anywhere in the world. It's Australia first, and then, ironically, daylight second. We know that the sun is trying to murder us by melting our skin into cancer. Every year, you can go down to one of Sydney's hundreds of glorious beaches, of which Bondi is the most overrated, and watch the carnival as Antipodean tourists, usually the English, say to themselves, "Oh, well, I don't need sunscreen, I don't burn," ha 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 ha, and then you get to see them combust in front of your very eyes. No, you don't burn in England, sonny boy, where there's an ozone layer. You in the jungle now, baby.
You're in the jungle now.
And it's all Thomas Midgley Jr.'s fault. So this is bad, right? We don't want this. Mario Molina had just discovered that there's a toxic gas eating away at the protective shell of the planet, and that's a sobering discovery for anyone. But it's not that bad, surely. I mean, we've got time, right? Global crises take hundreds of years to manifest. I mean, CFCs have only been around for about 50 years. It's not like carbon from smoke, which we've had forever. This is a distinctly 20th century thing. There is no way that there are enough CFCs out there to destroy the planet. So Molina sat down with a pen, some paper, and a calculator, and he did the maths. And then he did it again. And then he did it a third time, because this was not fun math. He calculated that there were indeed enough CFCs in the atmosphere to destroy the entire planet. Mario Molina himself recounted how after one day at the office, he came home one day and his wife asked how his day was and he replied, oh, yeah, you know, pretty good, I guess, except that it looks like the end of the world. And every day, more and more CFCs under the brand name Freon were being manufactured and pumped into the air. So Roland and Molina had just stumbled onto the apocalypse. Hurrah for science! Woo!
Well, I can't say I approve of the woo, but the hurrah was quite heartening.
And being diligent scientists, they wrote up their research so that the world might, you know, not end. In 1974, they published their findings on how Freon was going to end all life on Earth by the end of the 21st century. And nobody gave a shit. Well, not nobody. After the paper was published, Professor Sherwood Rowland got a call from the DuPont Chemical Corporation issuing a cease and desist order because the name Freon was a registered trademark, because humanity is awesome. Not to be deterred, Roland and Molina submitted the paper to the annual meeting of the American Chemical Society. This was the same place where Thomas Midgley Jr. had, 44 years beforehand, done his trick with blowing out a candle. Roland and Molina submitted their paper to the American Chemical Society and they crossed their fingers that they would be picked to appear. Because a lot of papers get submitted to the Chemical Society and not every paper can be featured. There are so many papers to go through and so little time. Papers with fascinating subjects like how to make dish soap 4% more efficient or how to make a better toaster. It's hard for something as mundane as the end of the fucking world to compete in that environment. Also, do not get me started on toaster technology. I can rant about this for hours. Just know that in the 1960s, Big Toast fucked up and we've never again had toasters that good. Anyway, back to the Armageddon paper. The American Chemical Society's news manager, one Dorothy Smith, it's her job to decide which papers to submit for the conference. And we need to give some well due credit here. Dorothy Smith picked the paper and put it on show. She's one of the very, very few people in this story, you can count them on one hand, she's one of the very few people who looked at the subject matter and said, the end of the world? Jesus fucking Christ, that's a huge deal. We need to be talking about this right now. Instead of saying something like, well, I'll be dead before all of this happens. I'd much rather be rich now. Fuck the children. Sound familiar? History has a mind to rhyme and two hype feet.
I told you, homeboy, you can't touch this.
So Dorothy Smith puts the Armageddon paper front and center. DuPont Chemical does not like this decision because they're the ones that own Freon and they're the ones making the money from it. Anything that makes Freon look bad would drive down their profits and we absolutely cannot have that. They call Dorothy Smith and put the hard word on her. They called it, quote unquote, an insignificant story. Yes, the force field that protects the planet from space lasers is being eaten away by CFCs and we're all going to die in less than a century. What a dead donkey of a story that is. Boo, boring, drop it. But Dorothy Smith stood firm and put Roland and Molina center stage at a press conference and finally, people started paying attention to the, once more for effect, end of the fucking world. Dorothy Smith, as much as anyone, can take some credit for saving the planet. And then the news cycle shifted to something else and we were back to being fucked. DuPont started their own counter campaign. They highlighted that there were no hard data about the depletion of the ozone layer. Nobody had ever gone up there and taken measurements. All of this slander, as they called it, was on the back of calculation and data projection, not actual observation. Ozone depletion is nothing more than a theory, they said. Or to quote DuPont directly, quote, all ozone depletion figures to date are complete projections based on a series of uncertain assumptions. End quote. And the rubes ate it up and they kept spraying CFCs into the air like the coal-rolling fuckwits they've always been. Yes, ozone depletion was a theory, and the scientifically illiterate have always had a problem with the word theory. Gravity is a theory, and yet here you all are sticking to the ground like a bunch of sheep. Wake up, sheeple, big gravity's got you. So the obvious solution was that we needed hard evidence to shut up the capitalists. Fortunately, there was one way to get that hard data. Since 1962, there has been a group of absolutely crazy nutters called the British Antarctic Survey. They are just what it says on the label. They're a bunch of scientists under British employ who hang around in Antarctica doing surveys just for the hell of it. And there's a lot of good science to be done in Antarctica because it's Antarctica. It's frozen and remote, so you don't get a lot of human interference. But you have to be crazy to do it because it's in Antarctica. I'm being very biased here, I just really, really hate the cold. Here's a fun tidbit about Antarctica. We've all seen March of the Penguins, right? Great film, heartwarming.
In the harshest place on Earth, love finds a way.
Given how cold it is in Antarctica, do you think, when those penguins die, do you think their corpses rot? Or do they just sit there, forever, frozen in the cold? Enjoy that image, Liebchen. So the British Antarctic Survey just sort of, you know, hang around in Antarctica collecting data. No data in particular, they just do random science there in the hopes that one day it will be useful. Because they're that kind of nutter. And it turned out that the data they were collecting was very, very useful indeed. Because they were measuring, of all things, ozone. The ozone measurements that they were taking were all over the place, to the point where the researchers began to worry that their equipment was broken. There was no rhyme or reason to the ozone readings, which was worrying because, I don't know if I mentioned this, but they're in Antarctica, where there shouldn't be any sort of human funk to gummy up any of the readings. So what they did was they got some new equipment in, because this is the problem you get with Occam's razor. Sometimes the simplest solution isn't always the correct one. What's more likely in that situation if you're one of these Antarctic scientists? What's more likely? That your equipment that you dragged to the coldest, most remote place on the planet might be on the fritz and giving off bad data? Or that the data you are collecting is correct and it looks like the world is ending? So they got new equipment in. And the new equipment showed the exact same thing. There was fuck all ozone in the Antarctic, where there should have been an abundance of ozone. This is less than ideal. They cross-checked their findings with data taken from the high-tech satellites of NASA. NASA's data said the same thing. There was fuck all ozone in the atmosphere. The reason that NASA hadn't said anything before was because they also assumed that the readings were false and threw them out. I mean, really? The ozone layer is gone? That's impossible. So, faced with the sobering prospect of the end of civilization, NASA rushed a team to Antarctica to figure out what the shit was happening. On October 20th, 1986, NASA released their findings to the world. At a packed press conference of all of the world's media, the Antarctic team delivered their report via a satellite uplink. And I'm paraphrasing here, but the report said, in brief, we're all fucked. And finally, we got some action on the world stage. When the world's leaders were presented with hard evidence that the planet was going to explode, they got things done very quickly. Commendably so, it must be said. In 1987, 198 sovereign nations of the world signed what's called the Montreal Protocol, an international treaty banning chlorofluorocarbons in the hopes that it might prevent the world from ending. And you're not going to believe this, but it worked. It actually worked. To quote the former United Nations Secretary General Kofi Annan, quote, "Perhaps the single most successful international agreement to date has been the Montreal Protocol." End quote. Sherwood Rowland and Mario Molina jointly won a Nobel Prize and the world began unfucking itself. At least in this one specific case. CFCs were phased out, and in the 35 odd years since they were banned, the hole in the ozone layer is actually healing. It's getting better. Armageddon was averted. This is a demonstration that it is possible to take large-scale, unilateral action against an environmental crisis and have it actually work. It can be done. It has been done, and it can happen again. It's just that there are some people out there who don't want to, and for some reason we keep voting for those fuckheads. But I digress. Thomas Midgley Jr. invented CFCs, and less than half a century later, as a direct result of his invention, the world nearly ended. That was the first time that Thomas Midgley Jr. nearly destroyed the planet. Oddly enough, not the last. When you're going through the list of history's most dangerous people, how many of them can you say nearly destroyed all of creation, and you have to qualify that with, which time are you talking about? Thomas Midgley Jr. had, among his many awards and accomplishments he won over his life, an honorary doctorate from The Ohio State University. Part of their citation of Thomas Midgley Jr. read thus. Midgley contributed so greatly to a more pleasant and efficient living, and we rejoice with him in the satisfaction that must be his in seeing the fruits of his labor. Posterity will acknowledge their permanent value. End quote. Which is, perhaps, the biggest swing and a miss in the history of glad-handing. Because posterity does indeed acknowledge Thomas Midgley Jr., but not for his value. No, for being the man who nearly destroyed the world. Twice. Because if at first you don't succeed, you find out the rest of the story in the next show. Don't act shocked, I told you this was a two-parter. Evince no surprise. It's just too hot for me to keep going. I do all this in one take and I'm pretty much spent. That's it for now. I'll see you real soon. As ever, thank you so much for listening. For all of the new friends I made in Perth, welcome. It's great to have you here. Come join the party, help yourself to the fridge. For everyone returning, welcome back. It's great to talk at you again. If you're feeling generous, please give the algorithm a nudge in my direction. You can do that by hitting like, which is good, or subscribe, which is better. That lets the machine know that I'm a person worth sparing in the inevitable robot uprising, and I can continue doing this. Sharing is also great. That's probably the best thing to do. Share, so feel free to do that. If you want links, I'm on all of the socials at /historygotime. Just, you know, put that in your browser or whatever. And if you want everything that I've just said in one convenient place, then go to linktree.com/historygotime. Websites are a dead technology. Linktree does everything that a website does, but better. And I can do all of it from my phone at the gym, which is beyond convenient, believe me. So linktree.com/historygotime. You'll find everything there. All right, I think that's everything. I'll be back in your ears real soon with the second part of this dyad. Do not miss Mr. Armageddon Part 2, Better Lead Than Dead. Title subject to change because I just riffed that off the top. God damn it, it's too hot today.
Oh, I'm sorry. I can't divulge information about that customer's secret illegal account. Oh, crap. I shouldn't have said it was a customer. Oh, crap. I shouldn't have said it was a secret. Oh, crap. I certainly shouldn't have said it was illegal. Ah, it's too hot today.